Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to the ADHD Science Podcast. I'm Max Davey.
And I'm Tess Davey. And I'm not in this episode.
No. Well, you are.
Well, I'm here now, but I'm... If you're just here to listen to me talking, which I know a lot of you are...
You'll be most disappointed by the subsequent half hour after this brief period of Tess.
No, you won't be disappointed, because it's a great episode.
It is a really good episode. So what we thought we'd do with this format... Basically, Tess is so busy at the moment that it's almost impossible to schedule a time when me and you and the guests can all do a recording together. So we've kind of split it off. So I have done a couple with just the guest, and what I'm going to do is explain to you what we talked about, and hopefully that will make it easier to then dive in for the listener to work out what it was. And I've got down from the shelf where it sat for the last 10 years...
A metronome. Why?
Now, this is why. I interviewed somebody called Anders Rasmussen, who is not only the most Swedishly named person in the world... But he also has been researching the... Well, let me explain. So what they do is they do this. They basically play to people with ADHD or without ADHD a regular rhythm. Okay? For a period of time. So you get kind of entrained with the rhythm. And then you stop. And then the person has to continue the rhythm, not tapping on a table in this case, but tapping on a phone.
Right.
And what they looked at is whether people with ADHD were better or worse than normies.
That's
the technical term.
We can't call people normies.
We cannot call people normies. We have that right. Whether they're better or worse than normies at maintaining the rhythm over time. So what would you suspect?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I'm going to say better.
Incorrect.
Are we worse?
So people with ADHD are worse. And I think partly because we tend to speed up.
Right.
We also tend to be less consistent with the rhythm because we get distracted in between beats as well.
Oh, God.
So the important thing about this is not... This isn't... You know, in some ways you would think this is just a bit of a curiosity, but of course, one of the things, it's because it's such a simple thing to do. I was able to do it with just, you know, you could do it with a phone, obviously, quite easily, but we happen to have a metronome in the house. You could do very easily on an app and then measure the response times. And essentially what they're looking at is, this is quite a good test. It's quite a good screening test for ADHD, whether you can maintain this rhythm.
Sure. I'm just thinking about the fact that both of my brothers have ADHD and are drummers.
Yeah, I know. I did point that out. But I think, yeah, it's interesting. But I think with as a drummer, maybe you train yourself out of that. I mean, drumming is a very stimulating experience, which is why I think a lot of people with ADHD are attracted towards it.
I used to drum.
Yeah, and you don't spend a lot of time drumming. I know you spend some time drumming, not drumming, but most of the time you are drumming. You're not waiting. Do you see what I mean?
I don't drum anymore.
But this is not what you're doing is sort of almost waiting for something that's not there to give you a cue, rather than if you're drumming, particularly in a band, you are drumming along to something that's keeping you in check. Anyway, this
very
isn't
interesting
necessarily
concept.
Very interesting concept, very interesting test, and has got real potential, not proven yet, and they're going to do some more stuff, or as a possible screener or helpful, you know, additional thing for ADHD diagnosis. And we need it because we are really struggling worldwide with the volume of people who want to be assessed. So any tool that will be helpful for us will be super helpful. And also it might be helpful for things like medication response and so on.
So what would... If you had to try and explain why that happens...
Why people with ADHD are worse at maintaining a rhythm that they are not hearing, I think it would be a combination of being a bit impulsive, so having a tendency to want to get on with the next beat, but also being... Yeah, we talked, didn't we, with Andrew Haig about how attention cycles very rapidly. And I think some of those micro inattentions, the kind of, what I mean is, because inattention you can think of as, oh, I concentrated on something for 30 seconds and then I got distracted for 10 seconds. But it can be faster than that. You can be concentrating on something and then very, very quickly be distracted, then come back to it at that very sort of microsecond level. That's what Andrew's work kind of was looking into. So it may be that some of those micro distractions or micro inattentions are contributing to the fact that people are not as good at this if they have ADHD.
You know who would be really good to talk to about this?
Who's that?
The person in the episode.
Let's talk to Anders Rasmussen about this very topic.
Well, you can do that.
Yeah, okay, I'll do that.
I was at work when this was recorded.
You were pulling pints. All right, see you in a bit.
Bye.
So, Anders, welcome. Welcome to the ADHD Science Podcast.
Thank you.
So we're going to dive straight in because it's such a fascinating area that you've been researching. What was the question that you were answering when you did your research that we're talking about today?
Well, so I mean, I'm interested in the role. So my niche has been the cerebellum since I did my PhD. I've been studying the cerebellum, which is the another name for the small brain, but which actually has 80% of the brain's neurons in it.
Wow.
That's something many people don't really know, but it has lots of neurons.
So just to give people, just to orientate people where the cerebellum is, it's sort of the funny bit on the back of the brain that sort of looks a bit separate but isn't.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It looks like a small brain, underneath the big chunk.
underneath the hemispheres. Go on. Yeah.
Yeah, so just to give you some background, I mean, I have a background in psychology myself, but then I moved into sort of hardcore neuroscience doing neurophysiology. But I always maintain sort of an interest in psychology. And then after studying the cerebellum for many years, we were approached by a psychiatrist who had read some studies showing that kids and adults with ADHD have there's some morphological differences if you look on average in like brain scanning and stuff like that. And one of the areas that had the biggest differences was the cerebellum. So then his idea was, do you have any sort of tests that measure cerebellar function? And could that maybe be used for diagnostic purposes or to find out more about ADHD and what it means in terms of neuroscience? So that's where we came from, in a way.
So let's wind that. That's great. Let's wind that back a little bit. What does the for people who are not, don't have a neuroscience background or a psychology background, even let alone both?
Yeah.
What does the cerebellum do in normal function? What's it for?
Yeah, good. So a good question. And something I often forget to to talk about. But so if you would open like a psychology or a neuroscience textbook and read about the cerebellum, it would say that it's important for balance and motor coordination.
Okay.
So if you would have a sort of someone who had a cerebellar stroke, for instance, what neurologists would do is to ask them to close their eyes and point to their nose like this. And then they have this, they would often miss their nose, for instance. So they have this problem with proprioception that the brain doesn't
sensing
really know.
Where your body is in space, in a way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's of course very important for balance. So they often have balance problems. And that's sort of what you get if you open a textbook, but the research has moved on and it's quite clear. You can look at what other parts of the brain the cerebellum is connected to. And then you'll find, yes, it's connected to the motor system, but it's also connected to all, cortical areas that are involved in sort of cognitive functions. And more research is showing that these cerebellar patients, yeah, they have obvious motor symptoms, but there's also many cognitive symptoms.
Okay.
And now I'd say the whole sort of cerebellar community of researchers are, I mean, there's a consensus that in the same way that the cerebellum helps the motor system, it helps sort of how you think. And in the same way that you can get uncoordinated motor movements, you can get uncoordinated cognition in a way.
So that's I suppose that sort of answers the what my next question was going to be, which is that, yeah, if you take a cerebellum away, you obviously remove a lot of your motor coordination. But what does it do to you cognitively if it doesn't work properly?
Yeah, so you can. There is this syndrome called, which was coined by Jeremy Schmaman. He's sort of the first one who identified that cerebellar patients don't just have motor symptoms. And so he coined this dysmetria of thought, which is that you have uncoordinated cognitive symptoms, basically, and that extends to emotional patterns as well, that you can sort of, the same way you can overreach with a movement, you can overreach with an emotional reaction or like go too far
sounding more and more ADHD every time you kind of reiterate it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. So it's very similar to ADHD.
Isn't it?
And now these findings came to that people with ADHD have actually pretty big differences in the cerebellum on average. But that, yeah, it's sort of, it's a neat story in a way.
It is a neat story. So that's the sort of cerebellum you're like, well, okay, very interested in the cerebellum in ADHD. And then the psychiatrist said, okay, what can we do in terms of practically testing this? So what was the suggestion and what did you then test?
Yeah, so then we had a few sort of tasks that we've done, that I've done for a long time, that we know from other research is sort of dependent on cerebellar function. It's not just the cerebellum, of course. It's really hard to find tasks that just sort of tap into one brain function. But
yeah, because it's so interconnected. That's just to reiterate that. Yeah.
Exactly. You always have to be careful with which conclusions you draw. But one task that I've been doing for 16 years is eye blink conditioning, in which, so maybe you've heard of it, but basically if you would hear a tone and then shortly after you get a puff of air in the eye.
Okay.
And at first you would just blink when you get the puff of air in the eye because of the blink reflex. But if you repeat this many times, then you learn to blink when you hear the tone.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a very simple form of associative learning.
Yeah.
And there's tons of research showing that the cerebellum is crucial for this. So if you remove the cerebellum, you won't be able to do that. And you can also look at cerebellar patients and so on.
Okay.
So that's one task. And then you have another one called finger tapping.
Yeah.
Where you have to maintain a rhythm. So then if you were tested in finger tapping, you would hear this metronome, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Like bum bum bum, and then you try to sync your movements to this one, and then the sound goes away and you have to continue for like a minute.
So
or
interesting.
Something.
Yeah. And how long do you have to how long do you continue to tap on the finger tapping one? How
one
long
minute, approximately? I mean you can minute. Do different amounts of time, and that has been tested. In our studies, we did 1 minute approximately.
Interesting. And the so tell me again, the eye blink, if you have cerebellar dysfunction, you don't condition as effectively to the puff of air?
Yeah.
So you're less likely to blink to the sound alone if you have cerebellar dysfunction.
Yeah.
Okay. So those are good. Those are very simple, particularly the finger tapping. That's the one that really excites me because it's so, so simple. You can you could do it with a laptop and a pencil.
Exactly. Yeah, the link is a bit more difficult to.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the one that really excites me. As a clinician, really excites me. So, what do you find when you look at those differences in those tests between ADHD and non-ADHD people?
Yeah, so I mean, we did this, and then you can look at several different sort of outcomes in finger tapping. So you can look at the sort of average tapping rate, and you can look at that when you have the tone on, see if they can sync their movements to the tone, and also after the tone has stopped, and see if they sort of do they accelerate their pace or do they maintain the same pace. And then you can also look at the variance in tapping, right?
Yes, so, I was wondering about that.
So, I mean, you might be able to, and actually you often see that after the tone stops, even controls will sort of increase their pace over time. So they have a target of 524 milliseconds. And most people are pretty good during the synchronization phase when they hear the tone, but then most people try to speed up slightly during the production phase, we call it, when there's no sound.
Yes, and it's a bit like that. I mean, if you've ever played a game where you will have the title of a song and you have to kind of know when the actual singing starts, and you have to kind of press a button when you think it's going to start. It's sort of a bit like that. You've got to think it in your brain and go. I mean, that's not quite the same because you've also got to know how many bars and how many, you've also got to know the song really well. But it's not dissimilar to that kind of thing. And so what's really interesting, what was specific about the ADHD population's response to this test?
So in the finger tapping, we saw effects on, the biggest effect was on the tapping rate during the production phase and the variability during the tapping, the production phase. So when there was no sound. So it was both that they had a higher, tapped quicker during the production phase. And that's even, so I mean, I should say that some people that we tested, and especially in the ADHD group, would go like, they would lose interest, even if it was just a minute. They would like eventually go down to like 200 milliseconds. They would just and that. So we removed such trials because that's
interesting.
That would be boredom, I would say.
And your subjects, were they adults?
No, this was kids.
And how old were they?
So it was between 9 and 15, I believe.
Okay, so that's a really, really good age to be testing. Okay,
and we're testing on adults right now as well, and we see effects there as well. But,
is it different in adults?
It is. So there's some effects that we saw in kids that we did not see in adults, but this one, I think the tapping rate still pans out. So there we have the same pattern. But I have to revisit the analysis on that one. And we're not completely done. So
no, sure. I'm not asking you to kind of reveal unpublished data, but I'm just curious. But it's making me think of other continuous performance tests that happen in ADHD. So there are things like the QB test, which is very, very common in the UK. I don't know if it is in Sweden as well, but it's absolutely huge over here now. Mm-hmm. And I'm not massively convinced that it should be just the cornerstone of all practice, but it is useful at times. Because they also manage, they also, in a sense, because that's a test where you either press the space bar when you should press the space bar or don't when you shouldn't, for whatever rules have been set up. And the thing that strikes me is that this is a bit like those kind of omission commission errors that come up in the QB test, and also the variability really kind of, because that really I think that's really interesting, the variability and the way that ADHD people will kind of have micro absences of attention and then come back. And that's where the variability comes from, I would probably say, that kind of the need to refocus, that kind of loses you or gains you cognitive time. So how good, because the QB test is sold as a test, and again, skepticism is relatively high for me. Is this a plausible test, or is it just a piece of information that you think would be useful for a clinician who's trying to put things together?
So I would say more the latter. And I mean, we do have the test you're talking about is used not everywhere in Sweden, but in many places in Sweden as well. And I mean, we also compared finger tapping in this case.
Oh, okay.
To that test. And so the finger tapping, at least in this study, and did have better like specificity and sensitivity.
Than the QB.
Yeah. But
okay.
But it's not, I mean, it's 29 kids, so I mean, I don't want to sort of
sure.
Conclusions and so on. And I also, I mean, I've been asked about this by several journalists, and I don't see this as something that we could just do this and then distinguish diagnosis based on only this. I mean, here
one needs to be really careful, which I think is where my skepticism about continuous performance comes in, because it's not that it's not useful, it's just it's not,
doesn't give the full picture, right?
What would you do if this was suggestive of ADHD but nothing else was, or conversely, if everything else pointed to ADHD but the person was absolutely perfect on this?
Can you repeat that question?
So I suppose let's rewind a little bit. So you're saying that it's more of a piece of information rather than a test.
Yeah.
So and I suppose I'm bringing in my own skepticism, not about continuous performance being a useful addition to a clinical assessment, but my skepticism that it should be a determine whether you make a diagnosis or not. That should be the one reason, you know, why you do or don't give a diagnosis. And for me, it can't be that.
No.
And I suppose so. You agree, right? But I suppose the question. Go on.
I just completely agree. And I mean, it has been here in Sweden as well. There has been this. I guess politicians have. I mean, they're searching for a screening tool.
Yeah.
I would not want to sell this as such.
No.
I mean, it should be just a piece of information. And what I'm also hoping is that it can be useful for clinicians, maybe to, in the end, sort of... find differences within the group of ADHD or something.
Yeah. So, oh gosh, there's so many different things. There's three different questions that I want to ask you all at once. First of all, what is the specificity and sensitivity for detecting ADHD? Bearing in mind that we're not going to use it as a standalone test, but what from this, and also bearing in mind it's a very small study, but in that study, what did you find?
So are you searching for the exact numbers here, or
it was
sort of 0.85 or 0.9.
okay.
And then so we could, when we combined the different cerebellar tests, we got slightly higher, but we were also, since finger tapping is such a short and quick and easy test, we sort of investigated that one the most, and
yeah,
that one on its own had very high.
Yeah, it's very good, basically.
Yeah,
But we're not going to. And is it commercial? Is it going to be commercially available? I mean, I know it's just finger tapping, but you need to have the timing and the detection of it. And is it commercially available? Will it be commercialized in that way?
So I'm collaborating with with some researchers in the Netherlands, and. So the answer is we're working on it, and but we would, I'd say we need to do some more testing and at a larger scale, but we're looking at maybe building it into sort of a mobile app, which could be done. So you could
use software good
in a mobile phone, and that would be
cheap. Yeah, with the touch screen.
Yeah.
That's such a great idea. And so, again, we're not looking for the magic screening test that's going to tell everyone who that whether they play in HD or not. We're really not. I agree. We're both on the same page about that. But you did mention something really, really, really interesting, which was different subcategories of ADHD, because I think you mentioned that in the paper. You mentioned DAMP, so we need to talk about a little bit about that. And so what do you find there and what do you think it could be useful for there?
So, I mean, the DAMP is it's sort of an old term that has, I don't know, did you have that in the UK?
No, but it's famously by, is it Chris Gilberg? He's a Swedish psychiatrist, so he came up with it. I think it's something that people are aware of in the UK, but it's not really diagnosed.
No.
I think it's been, well, to explain what it is, well, one of us will explain what it is.
So it's basically, the way I think about it, it's ADHD plus sort of motor coordination issues. And it's sort of, the way the psychiatrist I work with see it, it's sort of the more difficult form of ADHD in a way, and more, the people who are super hyperactive and so on tend to have that.
Tend to have motor coordination difficulties as well.
Yeah, so exactly.
That's interesting.
And for the finger tapping test, we saw that they were the ones who had the most difficulty as well.
Yeah, which makes sense because, of course, you've got somewhere which is something which is cut, which is testing the cerebellum. The cerebellum is very important for motor coordination. You have motor coordination difficulties in ADHD. It sort of makes sense. But I suppose the flip side of that is that even if you don't have motor coordination difficulties, even if your motor coordination is fine,
mm-hmm.
as whatever fine means, if you have ADHD, your finger tapping is going to probably be different.
Yeah. That's what we saw, because we also saw a difference between the people or the kids with ADHD who did not have motor coordination problems and controls.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not just about the motor. It's not just an artifact of the fact that kids with ADHD are more likely to have motor coordination difficulties. I suppose that's another objection or kind of weakness that you've kind of controlled for. So what as a clinician, as someone who diagnoses ADHD, what does this mean for us, for the people looking after children particularly, but also adults with ADHD? What are the implications of this?
So, I mean, at the current moment, I wouldn't say there's many implications, but I mean, as I hinted at before, my hope is that this would sort of that you could use this as a part of the assessment, and maybe if you do this and it doesn't take a long time, and then you follow these people, the kids who get the diagnosis or the patients, and maybe you see sort of that they differ in some way that could be helpful in terms of, I mean, ultimately what we want to give all the kids is the help that they need, right? And I don't know if you agree, I mean, you probably know more about this than me, but ADHD, at least in Sweden, I would say it's a very heterogeneous group. And in this group, you have some individuals who needs adaptations in school or at home. You have people who need medication and who really benefit from medication. So there's different ways of treating. And right now, I think you have to try the different ones in a way. I don't know if you agree with that. But
No, I mean, I absolutely do. And I don't think anyone who's listened to any of my episodes would doubt it. I mean, I think it's highly heterogeneous. I think the thing that your work says to me specifically is that we mustn't forget the motor coordination and the the praxis aspects of ADHD. So what I mean by praxis is the kind of planning, just for you, not for your benefit, for the audience benefit. What I mean by praxis is the kind of, as I understand it, the sort of planning of things, the getting from where you are to where you need to be, which is often impaired in ADHD, often in the absence of coordination difficulties. Still, planning stuff is hard. And the cerebellum is really important for praxis. As again, as I understand it. So it's a reminder, we can get, so I'm sort of answering my own question. I'm sorry about that. No. I think it's because Tess isn't here. I'm unleashed. The dog is also barking, which is annoying me, which is a theme of the podcast, so that's fine. Hang on, I am going to pause just two seconds. Yeah, he's just hungry.
Okay.
It's fine. So I suppose what I was going to say is we've often had a view neurologically of ADHD, which is very focused on the frontal cortex, very focused on the prefrontal cortex and inhibition and, you know, that sort of thing. And I've always been a bit skeptical of something which is so reductive, because you find changes in the brain all over the place, don't you?
Yeah.
So I think it's really important, part, you know, apart from all the fascinating stuff about the finger tapping itself, to think about the cerebellum, just other parts of the brain which aren't the frontal cortex, the cerebellum being one. But I just, you know, just a reminder that this is a neurologically diverse condition with involvement all over the brain, I suppose, is where I would kind of go with it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I mean, now I'm a cerebellar researcher, so I'm sort of biased.
Yes, perhaps, of course. But,
I mean, one sort of metaphor that we like to use is that the cerebellum is sort of like the X-ray at a hospital.
Okay.
It's like all the different departments need it. and when the cerebellum doesn't work, then all the different parts of the brain that it serves suffers a bit.
Excellent. But, yes. So, yes, nothing quite works without them.
Yeah, like, exactly.
It's like, yeah. I suppose there's lots of other things that the hospital doesn't work without, like the porters.
Yeah.
Can't go anywhere without the porters working. They're gone. That's you're all screwed. Yeah. Okay. I like that analogy. And I think that's right. It's a really good reminder that of the importance of motor coordination. And I think it is striking how often it's forgotten in ADHD assessments and in the management. Okay. And what does this mean for young people themselves? Are there any implications for ADHD people themselves to this work yet? Or is that something that you think we need to wait for?
Yeah, I think we need to wait for that. I mean, I wouldn't. I don't think so. Not right now.
No. Except you might be less good at rhythm games on the, you know, there's quite a few games out there. You might just not be as good as your mates at them at this point. Was it Wii Music? That dates me. That's quite a few years ago now. But there's lots of stuff on the Switch, isn't there? And kind of, you know, Guitar Hero and Drum Hero and all of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you're not going to be as good at that stuff. That's okay. But I think it underlies a really important point. And I suppose my final question is, what's next for you? What's next for your research? What are the questions that this has led you to go, okay, well, what now?
So, multiple things. So, I mean, one thing we're looking into is try to see if we can build this into a mobile app and then test on a much larger population and see if the results still pan out and look in adults as well. So that's one thing. Then we are also looking into ASD, which is, of course, another diagnosis. And at least here in Sweden, you have a lot of comorbidity between ADHD and ASD.
That comes up an awful lot in the podcast, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, you also have studies similar to the ones in ADHD, where they've shown that ASD, there you also see quite big differences in cerebellar morphology. So we want to study them and see sort of how do people with ASD only perform on finger tapping? How do people with comorbid ASD and ADHD perform and compare to ADHD? And also look at how does medication affect performance here?
Yes, I was wondering about that, as because you've got potential for this to be a useful therapy marker, potentially, if it's really that simple. It really does take that long, and it can be done on a mobile app. That really could be quite significant for you in the longer term.
Yeah, exactly. And then I guess the last thing that we're also looking into is doing some brain scanning and seeing if we can actually so using a high resolution MRI machine and see if can we sort of correlate the performance on these tests with the morphology of not just the cerebellum but the brain.
Okay.
And see if that
kind of bring it back to the anatomical side of things. Yeah. Well, I mean, amazing stuff, and thank you so much for sharing it with us. I mean, I think it is, as you say, a fairly small first study of something, but it just absolutely knocked my socks off. I'm like, wow, we could do that. That would be so great. So I'm so excited to see what you do next, and I'll try. And, well, you don't do social media. I don't do social media anymore, so we'll have to just keep an eye out for papers. But do get in touch if you want to come on and talk a bit more about your work, if it's gone any further, and if you want to basically just, you know, show off about this great thing you found, which is so exciting for me.
Yeah, no, I will, and I want to say thank you as well for reaching out. It's I haven't done this before, but it's
no, you did it was brilliantly, fun
and I hope I was interesting.
No, very, very, you were great, and you even listened to me starting to kind of go off on one in the absence of Tess, and you managed to cope with the dog being annoying and me needing to change laptops halfway through as well. But anyway, apart from that, it's been brilliant. So thank you very much, Anders, and we'll speak to you again soon, we hope. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Max.
Bye-bye.
Right. That was the episode. One day we will get you back on an episode.
You say properly. That like it's going to be years. It will probably be like a month.
It will be. You're working so hard.
Thank you.
Such long hours.
Thank you. And
you're doing exciting kind of, I don't want to say teenage things because you're barely a teenager anymore.
But excuse me?
You are 18.
Listen, I have a few years of youth to hang on to.
Okay, well, you're going to go off and do exciting things to your friends in Birmingham.
Yeah, I'm going to the Charlie XCX Brat Tour.
Very, very tonight. Good. Extremely, extremely excellent.
Uh-huh,
the sort
really
of place
excited.
That I would not be able to be seen, even though yes, I really like to go.
No, you
I
love that album, don't
I love,
lie.
I do love that album,
you love
but
that
I think
album.
I would feel so out of place going to it.
Well, you'd be fine. I'm sure there'll be a lot of supportive fathers there.
Yeah, no, I suppose there probably would be. Anyway, brilliant album. Listen to it. I thought everyone has.
Guys, if you are listening to this podcast, that means that you would love Brat, yeah. The remix album.
The remix album is particularly good. Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. It's not a music podcast. That may be something we can do.
Oh, God, no.
A little spin-off.
God, right. The only two non-musicians in the family.
Yeah, that's very true, actually. Anyway, so we will see you next time, which shouldn't be too long, because I've got another recording in the bag, mm-hmm. And it's just a question of pinning Tess down for 10 minutes.
Also, check the socials. Always check the socials.
Always check the socials.
Go on our Facebook
UK.
Page.
And I will, we're probably going to try and do another Q&A at some point because that was really fun.
And that's a lot more flexible time-wise.
Yeah. All right. Speak to you later. Bye.
Bye.